ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय हरे कृष्ण. Today we are reading from Canto 5, Chapter 25. Chapter 25 is entitled The Glories of Lord Ananta. Today we are on Text 2. So there is no vocative, we'll just do the prose word-to-word translation. Yasya.
Yasya.
Of whom?
Of whom?
Idam.
Idam.
This.
This.
Kshiti Mandalam.
Universe.
Bhagavatah.
Bhagavatah.
Of the Supreme Personality of Godhead.
Of the Supreme Personality of Godhead.
Anantamurte.
Anantamurte.
In the form of Anantadeva.
In the form of Anantadeva.
Sahasras
Shirashah.
Sahasras Shirashah. Who has thousands of hoods.
Who has thousands of hoods.
Ekasmin.
Ekasmin.
On one.
On one.
Eva.
Eva.
Only.
Only.
Shirshani.
Shirshani.
Hood. Driyamanam
is being sustained. Siddharthaha.
Siddharthaha
Eva.
And like a white mustard seed. Lakshyate
is seen.
Translation by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada ki. Translation. Sukadeva Goswami continued. This great universe, situated on one of Lord Anantadev's thousands of hoods, appears just like a white mustard seed. It is infinitesimal compared to the hood of Lord Ananta. There is no purport, so we'll go to text 3. Translation and purport for text 3. At the time of devastation, when Lord Anantadev desires to destroy the entire creation, he becomes slightly angry. Then from between his two eyebrows appears three-eyed Rudra, carrying a trident. This Rudra, who is known as Sankarsana, is the embodiment of the 11 Rudras or incarnations of Lord Shiva. He appears in order to devastate the entire creation. In each creation, the living entities are given a chance to close their business as conditioned souls. When they misuse this opportunity and do not go back home, back to Godhead, Lord Sankarsana becomes angry. The 11 Rudras, expansion of Lord Shiva, come out of Lord Sankarsana's eyebrows due to his angry mood, and all of them together devastate the entire creation. Om Ajnana Timirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtham Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Tadati Sva Padantikam Mukam Karoti Vachalam Pangum Langayate Girim Yat Kripa Tamaham Vande Shri Guru Dinatarinam Vancha Kalpa Tarubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Bhyayivacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare 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 Krishna. So we have just started a new chapter. This is verse 2 and 3 that we are discussing of the new chapter. Before this, we just finished discussing about the subterranean heavenly planets. And now, Sukadeva Goswami has moved on to discussing the glories of Anantadev. And why this progression has happened? Because in the previous chapter, in the last verse, he finished describing Patalaloka, which is one of the subterranean heavenly planets. And now he is describing how Lord Anantadev is situated at the core of Patalaloka, so below Patalaloka, and therefore he has naturally progressed to describe the glories of Lord Anantadev. Now, like most of us know, Lord Anantadev is an expansion of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He is Lord Vishnu's expansion, and he actually is sustaining this entire universe. That's what Prabhupada explains in the synopsis of this chapter as well. On all his rules is sustaining this entire universe. And you know, these descriptions that we hear, they actually make us realize the greatness of the Lord. And that is why Srila Prabhupada was always so insistent that read Srimad Bhagavatam in sequence. Do not jump straight to the pastimes, or do not skip some of the chapters thinking they are too technical. Like, obviously this was a very technical section. Fifth canto is very technical. It tests the faith of many people because it describes the various, the Vedic cosmology describes in great detail. And there, you know, we hear descriptions which are never heard of before, like the different oceans. Like, if you tell someone there's a sugarcane ocean or an ocean made of ghee, it actually tests their faith. So we see, and the whole description of where everything is situated, how the Surya, you know, we saw how the Surya Dev is also rotating in the universe, how it's going through various constellations. So it was all a very technical description that we've gone through. But Srila Prabhupada says it's very important we do that. We still go through that. We read it in sequence. And what more proof is there that it should be done in this sequence than Maharaj Parikshit, who is listening very patiently. He is on his deathbed. Now, nobody can have more urgency than Maharaj Parikshit. We all know we are going to die, but we don't think we are going to die in 6 or 7 days. That's not the realization that we have. I know we could die at any moment, but we don't have that, you know, realization or that, especially speaking of me, that understanding that I will die soon. So there should be an urgency. That sense of urgency, no one would have it greater than Maharaj Parikshit. But even then, he is very systematically listening to all these narrations from his spiritual master Sukhdev Goswami. In fact, it is described also that he prompts Sukhdev Goswami that do not rush through any sections. Like, please describe to me in great detail. So who would be a more appropriate recipient of just listening to the leelas of the Lord? When you are about to pass away, when you are on your deathbed, obviously you want to do Leela Smarana. So who would be more appropriate recipient than Maharaj Parikshit? But we still see he is not doing that. And Sukhadeva Goswami is also not doing that, being the speaker of Bhagavatam. He is still going very systematically, and he is still going in detail about creation. Like, if you proceed through the chapters, in some of the chapters there are prayers. And we saw that in the fifth canto, the different varshas, the lokas of different varshas are praying. Now sometimes, you know, as devotees, when we read these prayers, they seem so similar, they seem so repetitive. Sometimes, oh yeah, Lord, you are great, you are manifesting this whole cosmos, like, you know, similar prayers. We would feel like that in our conditioned states, again speaking of me, but we see Maharaj Parikshit is never tiring of hearing these glories. He's drinking all this through this nectar through his ears. So we are being given these descriptions about the greatness of the Lord only to make us realize how infinitesimal we are. And like it said in verse 2 translation, it said that this whole gigantic universe is resting only on one hood of Anantadev, and that too, in that one hood also it appears like a mustard seed. And Anantadev has thousands of hoods. So imagine on one of the hoods, there is a universe which is appearing like a mustard seed. So that gives us a description of how great the Lord is. And then when we read about Lord Ram's pastimes in the 9th canto or Lord Krishna's pastimes in the 10th canto, we will tend not to take them cheaply. We will not tend to think, like, take them sentimentally or emotionally, because we have realized that he's all this, what we are reading right now. So even destruction is very systematic. Now here we are seeing an aspect of Lord Sankarshan, and Rudra is being introduced over here. So it is said that Lord Shiva always has Lord Sankarshan or Anantadev in his heart all the time. He's residing. It said that is that Lord Anantadev considers that his glory, that he's residing in the core of the heart of Lord Shiva. And therefore Lord Shiva, and you know, we see in the verse 3 how he's coming out from the eyebrows of Lord Anantadev when Anantadev becomes angry. So because he has manifested from Lord Sankarshana, one of Lord Shiva's name is given as Sankarshana. Like Vasudev, Vasudev, like that. So one of Lord Shiva's name is Sankarshan, which is described in verse 3. So Shiva is addressed as Sankarshan because of that reason. Now destruction is also very systematic. For example, like, you know, if some house has to be demolished or a building has to be demolished, it's not that everybody will jump with hammers and start destroying whatever they want. Even for that, there is a plan in place. To destroy one small house also, there is a plan. First destroy this, then destroy this. Because while destroying, things can fall on your own head and you can die if you are not following a systematic plan and order. So in the same way, we are seeing over here, we will see, and it's described in the synopsis of this chapter, that destruction is also according to the Lord's plan only. It is not ad hoc. It is not untamed. It is not violent. So it happens, when we say ad hoc, it happens at a certain time only. So when it is the time for devastation, only then Lord Anantadev gets the desire of destruction, or I want to destroy. That desire comes when actually it is time for the destruction. So it's not that kabhi bhi, you know, suddenly he got the desire and he destroyed the universe. No, there is a time for all that. So again, the time is also very sequential and systematic. And how to destroy the universe and what sequence the universe should be destroyed, that is also very systematic. And we see over here, it's described that actually this instruction is given to Lord Shiva on how to destroy this universe by Lord Anantadev. And therefore, because Lord Anantadev is responsible, he is involved in the destruction of the universe, sometimes he is addressed as Tamasi or in the mode of ignorance. But obviously, he is none other than an expansion of Lord Vishnu. So we know that he is not Tamasi, he is in the mode of pure goodness. But he assumes this role only so that the destruction, that function of destruction can happen in this universe. So all these descriptions just help us realize that, you know, if one expansion of the Lord can do such great things that he can destroy this entire universe, and the universe is such a small, insignificant mustard seed on top of his hood, then where are we, the jivas who are insignificant within this universe? So it's just making us, you know, open our eyes to this aspect of the Lord. So now, and plus it says here in verse 3, it says that at the time of devastation, when Lord Anantadev desires to destroy, he becomes slightly angry, it is described. Now, why does he become slightly angry? So it is said that obviously destruction is in the mode of ignorance, and anger is also in the mode of ignorance. Now, to destroy something, you know, there is a whole beautiful creation. To destroy that, you need to have a certain constitution or a certain frame of mind. So obviously, because of that also he gets angry, because if you are, you know, completely transcendental and not displaying any other emotions, obviously his anger is also transcendental. But if that state of mind is not achieved, how will the whole function of devastation happen? So he becomes angry, but there is a very important reason which Prabhupada describes why he becomes angry. He becomes angry because there were so many opportunities given to the jiva to reform their life. So many opportunities given to the jiva to take to Krishna consciousness or take to devotional service to the Lord. So many opportunities the Lord gives. And how does he give these opportunities? The Lord is a very persistent teacher and a very loving father, full of compassion. So he himself comes. Every yuga he comes. We know there are yuga avatars, there are so many incarnations that keep coming. So he himself comes to attract the jivas back. That is an opportunity which is given. Then he performs so many leelas when he comes. So leela avatars, again he does these to attract people back so that they become attracted to his leelas by seeing his leelas, and then they desire that, no, enough of this world, let me go back. He also sends so many of his representatives to actually preach to people about the glorious path of bhakti and how this material world is futile and to go back to Godhead. And then he sometimes in his books, all the Puranas, the Vedic literature, Srimad Bhagavatam, he has sent so many books as well so that people can take shelter and go back or develop the desire at least of going back to Godhead. And if all this is not enough, you know how Samaveda Danda, sometimes he uses Danda. So he will send huge devastations, like those mini devastations he will send, like a tsunami or an earthquake. We all experienced. Or pandemic, COVID pandemic, yes. So he sends all these reminders. We are in the midst of pandemic, on top of that we all experienced that earthquake a few weeks ago. So these are just reminders by the Lord to make us realize that this material world is temporary. You know, those tsunamis, for example, if a tsunami comes, now all these houses on the beach road, on Beaconsfield Parade, they must be millions of dollars. Everything is gone in one instant. One wave can come and just wash the house away. Or an earthquake happens, buildings and buildings get broken and fallen. So he sends these reminders to everyone in the material world that this is not a place for permanent residency. Like people celebrate when they get PR of Australia or green card of America or something, they celebrate. but nothing, the whole material world is temporary, then what you are celebrating permanent residency of one small country. So he is making us realize it's all temporary, and he is telling, come back, don't stay here. Because if you don't come back, this is what will happen. And you will anyway lose everything. You might lose your life or your possessions. Anyway, that is going to happen. So still people don't take the message. Still people, not that after earthquake, you know, most of the people became God conscious. They still don't realize this. So we are just finishing the 12th canto with our teacher, His Grace Keshav Prabhu. Our final exam is there next week, and that brings us to the end of our 12 cantos of study. So in the 12th canto, in the 4th chapter, which is entitled as 4 categories of universal annihilation. So we see even in the Bhagavatam, this, you know, message of annihilation or destruction keeps coming. It's not that it's only there in the 5th canto and then all leelas will start. Again in the 12th canto there's a reminder. When, you know, the symptoms of Kali Yuga being spoke about, the deterioration of the age of Kali is being spoke about, again this reminder comes about the 4 categories. Again, you know, still Parikshit Maharaj has not left the world yet. He will leave in the 6th chapter. But in the 4th chapter, again Sukadeva Goswami is making him, he is giving him a reminder of the 4 types of universal annihilation. And those 4 types of universal annihilation, as described by Sukadeva Goswami, are constant annihilation, occasional annihilation, elemental annihilation, and final annihilation. So this is the cycle which the universe goes through and jivas also go through. So constant annihilation is nothing but birth, disease, old age, and death. Because one person, one jiva, whether it's in the human form or any other form of life or any species, they go through this cycle. And that is called as constant annihilation. Constantly people are dying, you know, taking birth again, dying, taking birth again in different species. Then the occasional annihilation is the one which happens at the end of Brahma's day. So we have read, all of us have read so many times in the Bhagavatam, how at the end of Brahma's days there's a partial destruction that happens. And all the universes still, even the heavenly planets, everything gets destroyed except the top 3 planetary systems, Jana, Tapa and Maharloka. Only those 3 are saved, otherwise the partial destruction destroys everything in the occasional annihilation. And then there is elemental annihilation. So elemental annihilation is when everything gets destroyed. All the elemental means all the elements merge back into the origin, which was, you know, the egg, which where the egg came from. So everything goes back into Garbhodakshaya Vishnu. He also merges back into the body of Mahavishnu. And that happens at the end of Brahma's lifetime. So that is called as elemental annihilation, where nothing is left. Even this whole universal egg is also going back. And the jivas are still under Sushupti and going back into Mahavishnu's body. And final annihilation is actually when a jiva realizes his eternal position as being the servant of the servant of the Supreme Lord, and he realizes that this is not his permanent home. His permanent home is back in Vaikuntha, in the spiritual world, and he actually gets liberation from the cycle of birth, disease, old age and that, and he goes back home, back to Godhead. So that is called as final annihilation, where he is free from this bondage of his body and of the material world of Maya. So we see this message of universal annihilation being described again and again and again. And we see how the Lord becomes angry when a jiva does not take, even though there are so many messages, there are so many reminders. Our own death or near and dear one's death itself is a reminder that this material world is temporary, this body is temporary. And we see so many times, you know, there is a term called Smashana Vairagya. Smashana Vairagya means when somebody dies, people become so renounced, like even in funeral homes or at the Smashan Ghat. People say, oh my God, this life is so temporary. You know, at that time people are very receptive because they have seen somebody of their near and dear one has left the body and gone. But why it's called Smashana Vairagya? Because it lasts only till the Smashan. Once people come back home, again, you know, the covering potency of Maya takes over. Again, people just go about their normal life and they do not care about, okay, he has died, I also need to now prepare for my next destination. So, but we see that the Lord actually becomes angry because we are not doing that, and therefore he, you know, desires to destroy, and then he instructs Lord Shiva. So the Rudras come out from between his eyebrow, and then they all carry out the function of destruction of this, or they help Lord Ananta Dev in the function of devastation of this whole world. So today we will discuss it's a very apt verse because today it is actually Vijayadashmi as well. Vijayadashmi is, you know, a very important festival, a very important festival for Vaishnavas. It's celebrated by millions. It's the day when Lord Ram had victory over Ravana. He killed Ravana. And it's also the appearance day of Madhavacharya, who is one of the prominent Acharyas in our own Sampradaya and in the four bonafide Vaishnava Sampradayas. He's a prominent Acharya. But it's very apt that how the Lord gets angry when an opportunity is given to a Jiva. And in the same way, we see this is very symbolic, because Lord Ram gave so many opportunities to Ravana as well to reform, to give Mother Sita back, to realize that, okay, you know, he's the Supreme Lord, I should not touch somebody else's property, especially, you know, I should not try to enjoy the goddess of fortune without her husband. So many opportunities Lord Ram gave, but ultimately there was no other Ravana, he could not put sense into Ravana, and therefore he had to ultimately kill him and get the world rid of this particular demon. So millions, as I said, millions of people celebrate this festival. Now, because of lockdown, I'm not sure how much celebrations must be happening, but otherwise millions of people gather together to celebrate this particular festival of Vijayadashmi. And it comes at the end of the 9 days long Navaratri, which was celebrated. So yesterday was Navami and today is Dashmi. So Navaratri is also an important festival where Goddess Durga is glorified and celebrated. And then on the 10th day, the victory of Lord Ram over Ravana is celebrated. But how do people celebrate? Normally, if we see, they celebrate in India especially, they might burn effigies of Ravana. You know, there are some such celebrations they do. But the problem is that most of the people, like most festivals we see, they celebrate it and the occasion is mostly used for social entertainment or to meet each other, to exchange sweets or eat sweets, like cook nice food, eat. But the whole spiritual significance of the festival is sometimes lost. People do not realize. They feel that, oh my, you know, my grandparents, my parents, my grandparents, you know, it's been happening. The celebration has been happening like this since generations in our family, and so we are continuing to celebrate. That is how normally people think, without actually realizing, why am I doing this celebration? What was actually the spiritual significance of this festival that I'm celebrating today? So very herd mentality we generally see in people, especially in Kali Yuga. So it is a characteristic that sacred things in Kali Yuga are taken very superficially. So even the festival, like mostly, like here we don't have obviously, but in India it's a holiday on Dashera. So people think, oh nicely, it's a holiday, go and enjoy. Break from work and go and enjoy. So we see it's such a sacred thing, but it's taken very superficially, and they lose out the opportunity on going deeper in understanding what this festival stands for and what does it signify in their own life. People lose that opportunity normally. So this particular festival is actually both historical and symbolic simultaneously. It has both historic and symbolic significance. Now historically we know today is the day when Lord Ram had victory over Ravana. He rid the world of this cruel, the world and the universe, of this cruelty which Ravana was doing. He actually achieved the essential purpose for which he had come down to this world. Obviously, Lord Ram had come to the world to get rid of Ravana, because Ravana had created havoc in the whole universe. So it's a historical, so that way it has historical significance, because Lord Ram killed Ravana. He rid the world of this cruelty. And in terms of symbolic significance, Dashera actually signifies, today it represents the victory of good over evil. And we've heard that many times, we've heard that from, you know, senior Vaishnavas, even in India sometimes our parents would tell us. So it represents the victory of good over evil, it represents the victory of godliness over godlessness. It also represents a victory of love over hate or envy. And it also represents how one can defeat the all-powerful Maya, and how one can establish the Supreme Personality of Godhead in their heart. How one can surrender, take this opportunity to surrender to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, which unfortunately Ravana did not take up. So, and it actually gives us a ray of hope, this particular festival, because we realize that yes, victory will be for the good over evil. Ultimately, the Lord will allow good only to prevail. Like we see even in, you know, every leela of the Lord, we see in Krishna's pastimes also, how he did not want the adharmic kings to rule, and therefore, even though if it was through a battle, a huge battle, he got rid of all the adharmic kings and he established the Pandavas, the dharmic kings over the kingdom of Hastinapur. So again, you know, it's very symbolic, because if we see in Satya Yuga, the way people, you know, the world was divided was devotees and demons used to live in two different planets in Satya Yuga. And then, you know, as the age keeps deteriorating, as it keeps going ahead, in Treta Yuga, they came much closer to each other, but they would live in two different countries. And then Dwapar Yuga, they came even much closer to each other, and the devotees and demons would be from the same family. Like we saw, you know, Kauravas and Pandavas, same family we saw, adhar, completely adharmic and completely dharmic. And in Kali Yuga, they are residing, the devotional tendency and demoniac tendencies, or the devotees and demons are residing within the same body. It's come so close. So, in Satya Yuga, different planets altogether. But in Dwapar Yuga, in Treta Yuga, which is the Yuga we are talking about, where Lord Ram had victory over Ravana. Ravana used to reside in Lanka and Lord Ram was in India, in Bharatvarsha. So, at least it was two different countries. And in Dwapar Yuga, at least it was two different families. But in Kali Yuga, with everything deteriorating, it's residing in the same heart, in the same body. So for us in Kali Yuga, we are not fighting any demons outside. There is no war going on outside. I know we have other wars happening, but this, you know, fight with the demons and all that is not anything which is external in Kali Yuga. For us, it is all inside. The war is within. The fight is inside all of us. We are always fighting the lower tendencies, even as devotees, again, you know, speaking of myself, always fighting the lower tendencies, because the lower tendencies have such a big, they have a big tendency to take over very easily. So we are always fighting these lower tendencies in our heart. We are always fighting the conditioning, which has been there since millions and millions of lifetimes inside us. We are always fighting our bad old habits. You know, some people like to, from their childhood, they might have watched lots of movies, heard lot of music. So, it keeps coming. You know, sometimes in dreams, you suddenly think of that song which you used to listen in your childhood, or that tendency to watch movies, or the tendency to even hear songs. Or these old bad habits keep coming up. The conditioning keeps coming back. We are fighting the lower tastes, so that we keep being situated in the higher taste. So, this constant fight is there. The inner voice, or the, you know, our consciousness, which is the Paramatma, obviously, is always telling us what is right. But the mind is always telling us, we have not made it our friend, it's always telling us, enjoy, enjoy, enjoy. And it's always dragging us lower and lower and lower. So we see this constant fight is there inside us, because the demoniac and devotional tendencies both reside in our heart together. So it is almost said like there is a fight between the good dog and a bad dog. There are two dogs residing inside us. There is a good dog, and which represents the higher tendencies, the purpose of real goal, purpose of life. Well, the goal of life is to achieve, you know, lotus feet of Lord Krishna. So that good dog is there inside us, giving us the message. The voice of the Paramatma is also always reminding us. Are you sure you want to waste your time? Like, you know, so much time goes on social media also. WhatsApp, Facebook, Instagram, so many things take our time away. And that time always there will be a voice which will remind you, you're wasting time, you know, that voice reminds us. So we see there is this fight between a good dog and the bad dog. But ultimately, which dog wins? And Srila Prabhupada says, the dog which wins is the dog we feed more. That dog will always win. So if we are feeding the bad dog more, which means we are succumbing to our lower tendencies again and again and again, then that is the dog which will keep winning. However, if, you know, through determination, through surrender, through the process of bhakti, instructions of so many senior Vaishnavas and Guru, we try to feed the good dog. It might be hard. The good dog might be very weak. And, you know, we might see we are feeding the good dog, but nothing is happening. But if we keep feeding that good dog, we will see one day we will be able to have that determination to fight the bad dog off. So Prabhupada says that we keep feeding the good dog even though it is very hard, and we might sometimes see the good dog is not winning. Every time we succumb to our lower tendencies and we think, oh, the bad dog won. But still we keep trying to feed the good dog by trying to do what that inner consciousness or the Paramatma is telling us. Chaitya Guru is directing from us from within, so that that good dog regains strength slowly, and it helps us in overcoming all these bad tendencies. So we see there are so many greatly successful people in Kali Yuga. Like materially, they must have so much success. And we see so many cases in the newspapers as well. Big corporate leaders, like CEOs of organizations, they would have achieved so much, studied in the best universities, achieved so much success in life, but ultimately they give in to that lower tendency, that lust which is there in their heart, and they have an affair with some woman or with some secretary or something like that, or they, you know, did some sexual abuse or something like that, and they ultimately lose everything, even material success they lose. They are removed from that position, they have such a shameful exit from their organization or wherever they are working, or even a government position they might be holding. So this lust, which is the all-devouring enemy, which is so strong in our hearts, that is why, you know, we see Krishna also says that, he reiterates that message in the Bhagavad Gita when he says, Kama esha krodha esha rajoguna samudbhava mahashano mahapapma vidhiyenam iha vairinam. So he says the lust is the all-devouring sinful enemy of this world. And we see Ravana is a representation of that lust. Now the Lord is actually very merciful. So like we said, the Dashera or Vijayadashmi actually signifies the victory of good over evil. It signifies the victory of compassion over evil as well. Because the Lord is very compassionate. It's not that he wants to kill these demons. When he comes to this world or even in the spiritual world, he reciprocated. He is always reciprocating according to the desire of the jiva. Now if a jiva desires friendship with the Lord, obviously he reciprocates by giving his friendship. If the jiva desires love, conjugal love, the Lord reciprocates with the jiva like that. Or if they desire to servitorship, that I want to be your servant, my Lord, the Lord definitely reciprocates. But there are some jivas who actually desire to be the enemy of the Lord. And we see that happening with Ravana. His desire was to fight. We see that happening with Hiranyakashipu and Hiranyaksha as well. Their desire was to be the enemy of the Lord. Their desire was to fight the Lord. So then the Lord is reciprocating like that. Even, you know, a devotee might sometimes have the desire to fight. Like we see Bhishma Dev. He was in Virya Rasa, but that is in devotion. So then the Lord reciprocates accordingly. And that time the Lord did not feel the arrows of Bhishma Dev were piercing him or they were causing him some. He felt they were flowers coming on him. Because the Lord loves, he loves a good fight and he loves to fight with none other than his devotees. But in case of Ravana or Hiranyakashipu, and of course we know their spiritual position, but in this material world they had this desire to be the enemy of the Lord. So the Lord had to reciprocate like that. So Ravana was given so many chances. The Lord did not just go and slay without any reason. Same way like he gave so many chances to Duryodhan. He himself went as a peace messenger. He tried everything. Same with Ravana. He sent a messenger. Angad he sent as a messenger. Vibhishana gave good counsel to Ravana. Even Maricha, it started when he was sending him as a golden deer. He told him, I have experienced this Ram. Don't even think of going near him or kidnapping his wife. So even before Ravana kidnapped Sita also, he was given good counsel. But he did not listen because lust. He was completely overpowered by lust for Mother Sita. So Maricha gave him good advice. Even Vibhishan gave him good advice. What to speak of Vibhishan? Even Kumbhakarna gave him good advice. He said, for one woman you are fighting, just return this wife to him. Why do you want this whole war to happen? But he did not agree and Kumbhakarna said, okay, I am committed to you, so I will help you fight in this war. But he knew he was going to die. And even Mandodari. So when I was preparing for the class, I was hearing when Ravana died and he collapsed on the ground, dead, you know, with so much blood coming out of all his mouths, and he collapsed on the ground. That time Mandodari came to Ravana and she was holding him and she was beating her chest and she was lamenting. She was saying that because Mandodari had also given good counsel to Ravana. But he said, I gave you good counsel. I said, don't go behind this chaste woman. She is the wife of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Why do you want to enjoy her when you have so many other wives to enjoy? And all of Ravana's wives were very beautiful. It's not that, you know, they were some, you know, weird looking rakshasis. He had very beautiful wives, but he was not satisfied. And Mandodari says, when she's over the dead body of Ravana, she says that, your lust, the lust in your heart has brought about your downfall, and the curse of a chaste woman has actually made you meet with your nemesis, with your end. So we see he received so much good advice, but he did not heed to any of the good advice. And very symbolic, because today's verse also says, Prabhupada says, so many opportunities are given to a jiva, but they do not take up that opportunity to become God conscious. And then obviously the Lord becomes angry. Anantadeva becomes angry and he wants to destroy. In the same way, obviously, Ravana was not returning Sita. Even when Vibhishan came to surrender to Ram, and you know, the monkeys were questioning that, should we take him? He's the brother of the enemy, this, that. There was a big discussion. And that time Ram says that anyone who surrenders to me, I will never fail to give him shelter. If tomorrow Ravan comes and says that I am surrendering to you, my Lord, I will not kill him, I will take him under my shelter. So the Lord gave so many opportunities for somebody to surrender, but obviously then he became angry because he had to. It was his duty to save Mother Sita and he had to rid the world of the cruelty of Ravana. So we see that is why he came, he achieved the purpose on the day, like on today, he achieved the purpose for which he had descended on this earth, gave so many opportunities to Ravana to reform, but ultimately he had to kill him. So we will not go into the details of how he killed him. We all know that story, how Agastya Muni had given him a weapon and Vibhishan then advised him that, because Lord Ram kept trying to cut off the heads of Ravana, but every head was again and again growing back and he was getting baffled. So again, you know, it's very instructive and it's so nice to see that the Lord is always wanting to give credit to his devotees. Now, he is the supreme personality of Godhead, all knower. He wouldn't know how to kill Ravana, but he gives the credit to Vibhishan of giving him the advice. And Vibhishan tells him. Now, there are different versions. You know, one version says that Vibhishan tells him it was in the heart, the nectar is in the heart. And you kill, you know, you pierce the heart of Ravana and that nectar will dry up. And in another version, it's in the navel. So different yugas, different versions are there. But that weapon had been given to him by Agastya Muni, the arrow with which Ravana would be killed. And then Vibhishan revealed to him that no point in cutting off his heads, because they are going to keep coming back. You just attack that nectar which is there in his heart. And that's how Lord Ram, taking the advice of Vibhishan, he killed Ravana. So we'll move on, which is also the appearance day of Madhavacharya. So there is a beautiful book which has been written by none other than our Param Guru, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, called as Life and Teachings of the Four Acharyas. It's a wonderful book. So I was reading that book to prepare for the class, and very nice points he says over there. So what we understand from our readings of these books is that there are four authorized sampradayas. From four sources in this world, four authorized or bona fide Vaishnava sampradayas. So one sampradaya comes from Brahma, the other one comes from Lord Shiva, which is Rudra sampradaya, the other one comes from Lakshmi Devi herself, which is Shri sampradaya, and then the last one is from the Kumaras, the sons of Brahma. And there are four prominent acharyas who came in Kali Yuga to actually preach or spread the message of these four sampradayas. So in the Rudra Sampradaya, we see Vishnu Swami came to propagate this particular Sampradaya, and their philosophy is called as Shuddha Advaitavada. So that is Rudra Sampradaya. The Kumara Sampradaya, there was a great devotee called Nimba Aditya, who was also called as Nimbarkacharya, and their philosophy was Dvaita Advaitavada. And then we have the Sri Sampradaya, where we had Ramanujacharya who came. And their philosophy is Vishishta Advaita. And then coming to Brahma Sampradaya, we have Madhavacharya who came in Kali Yuga. And that philosophy is called as Dvaitavada. So these are the four prominent acharyas who came. And these are the four philosophies which are significant or symbolic of these four sampradayas. Now Baldev Hridaya Vidyabhushan, in his writings, he first referred to the term Gaudiya, Brahma Madhava Gaudiya Sampradaya, in his book called Premaya Ratnavali, Prameya Ratnavali. He referred to this terminology. You know, we call ourselves as the Brahma Madhava Gaudiya Sampradaya. So that terminology was first said by Baldev Vidyabhushan in Prameya Ratnavali. And therefore, sometimes some people mistakenly think that actually Baldev Vidyabhushan is the one who identified Gaudiya Vaishnavas as Brahma Madhava Gaudiya Sampradaya. But this is not the correct. Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur says in his book that this is not correct. So he says that Gadadhar Pandit, who is one of the Panchatattva, his disciple was Gopal Guru. And Gopal Guru Goswami's disciple was Dhyanachandra Goswami, who accepted Brahma Madhva Gaudiya Sampradaya. So at that time itself it was called Brahma Madhva Gaudiya Sampradaya. And even going back to the source, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself, he took initiation from Sri Ishwarapuri, whose spiritual master was Sannyas initiation, whose spiritual master was Madhavendra Puri. So Madhavendra Puri is the guru of Ishwarapuri and he is from the Madhva Sampradaya, Brahma Madhva Sampradaya. So that is how Chaitanya Mahaprabhu established that link between Gaudiya Vaishnavism and Brahma Madhva Sampradaya by taking initiation from Srila Ishwarapuri, whose guru was Madhavendra Puri, who is actually coming from the Brahma Madhva Sampradaya. In fact, it is described that Madhavendra Puri, so obviously the Madhavas we say, or the Brahma Madhavas, they have a different way of worshipping the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And we see Udipi Krishna, who is the main deity for the Madhavas, or people who are followers of that particular sect or Vaishnavism, they worship Udipi Krishna, who is standing with a churning rod and a rope and butter, and there is no Radharani or anybody, like no Gopi Bhav is there in that particular worship. But Madhavendra Puri was the first Acharya in that Sampradaya who actually manifested Gopi Bhav. And he actually accepted Srimati Radharani's position as being the best devotee of Lord Krishna. And when he was leaving this world, he was so much in separation and he was reciting verses about Gopi Bhav. So that, you know, Vipralambha Seva, that is something which Madhavendra Puri first propagated, even though he was from the Brahma Madhava Sampradaya. Now, Bhakti Vinod Thakur and Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, they have both written extensively about these sampradayas. So it is said during Bhakti Vinod Thakur's time, the people generally in Bengal, in Gauradesh, are not so much aware about these four sampradayas and the Vaishnavism, how one should take initiation from a bona fide sampradaya. Not so much awareness was there. So through Sajjana Toshni, the magazines that he used to write, he used to talk to people about these sampradayas. And then Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur also took up that baton and he also kept writing books about the four sampradayas. In fact, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, when he established 64 Gaudiya Maths all over India, and of one of the maths which he has established in Dhaka, that math is named as Mathava Gaudiya Math. So we see how Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur was so respectful of this origin of our Sampradaya. And if even all of us must have seen, when we go to Mayapur, to the Gaudiya Math or the Chaitanya Gaudiya Math of Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, we see that he has established the four Acharyas, deities of the four Acharyas in four corners of the temple. So we can actually see Vishnu Swami, Nimbarkacharya, we can see Madhavacharya and Ramanujacharya, along with the four sources. We see the deity of Brahma, Lakshmi, Kumaras and Lord Shiva. So that is the importance Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur used to give to Vaishnavas connecting to their roots, and therefore he had done all these things. Now even Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he accepted two principles from each sampradaya. When Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was there, he also was propagating about these sampradayas and he accepted two principles from each sampradaya. And in fact it is described that these four acharyas took birth in Gauralila to assist Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in his preaching mission and in establishing the Yuga Dharma of the chanting of the holy names. So in Ramanujacharya, he was born as Ananta, a devotee called Ananta, who lived next to the house of Vallabhagat or Vallabhacharya. And the two principles which Chaitanya Mahaprabhu took from Ramanuja Sampradaya was Ananya Bhakti, which is unalloyed devotion to the Supreme Lord, free of jnana and karma. And the second principle which he took from this particular sampradaya was Bhakta Jana Seva, or service to the devotees. So these are the two principles Chaitanya Mahaprabhu accepted from Ramanuja Sampradaya. Now Madhavacharya, who, you know, we will discuss his glories in a few minutes, but Madhavacharya is none other than the third incarnation of Vayudeva. So he came as Hanuman to serve Lord Ram, he came as Bhima to serve Lord Krishna, and now in Kali Yuga he came as Madhavacharya. So he is an incarnation of Vayudeva or Hanuman or Bhima. And in Gaur Leela he was born as Murari Gupta to assist Lord Chaitanya in his pastimes. And the two principles which Chaitanya Mahaprabhu took from the Madhavacharya or Madhava Sampradaya was complete defeat of Mayavad philosophy, or it is called Kevale Advaita Nirashana. And the second principle he took was worship of the deity form of Krishna and as accepting Archavigraha as the eternal representation of Lord Krishna. So that is the second principle he took from Madhavacharya. The third one was Vishnu Swami, which Vishnu Swami is a prominent Acharya in the Rudra Sampradaya as we saw. So Vishnu Swami was born as Vallabha Bhatt, again in Gaudadesh. Also later he was known as Vallabhacharya. And later on by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's blessings, he perfected his own Sampradaya. So Vallabhacharya actually then went into, you know, he followed the teachings of Vishnu Swami and he, you know, the Pushti Marg that we see, that is none other than propagated by Vallabhacharya. But he was born as Vallabha Bhatt during Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's time. And the two principles Chaitanya Mahaprabhu took from Vishnu Swami or from Rudra Sampradaya was total dependence on Krishna. Tadiya Sarvasya Bhava, it's called. Complete dependence or complete shelter of Lord Krishna and Raga Marg. Raga Marg means spontaneous loving devotional service. Because they worship the Bal Gopal form of Krishna. So they have that spontaneous Vatsalya Bhava or parental Bhava for Lord Krishna. And then from Nimbarkacharya, he was reborn as Keshav Kashmir during Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's times. And from him, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu took two principles from Nimbarka Sampradaya, which is also coming from the Kumaras, which is exclusive shelter of Radharani, Ekanta Radhika Shraya, and Gopi Bhava. So these are the two principles Chaitanya Mahaprabhu took from that particular Sampradaya. So, you know, sometimes the stress is on accepting in ISKCON especially we see it is being so much propagated that we should accept spiritual initiation from a bona fide guru. And therefore Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, even Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, Bhakti Vinod Thakur, they were all stressing so much the importance of this. And Krishna departed knowledge to Brahma when the universe was created, who in turn gave knowledge to Narad Muni. Narad Muni gave that particular spiritual knowledge to Vyasadeva. And then Vyasadeva gave that knowledge to Madhvacharya. And coming in that lineage, obviously he had Madhavendra Puri, then Ishwara Puri, then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the six Goswamis, and you know the Shamanan Pandit, the next layers, Baldev Vidya Bhushan, all of these. And then we have our glorious Guru Parampara, Jagannath Das Babaji Maharaj, Bhakti Vinod Thakur, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and our glorious Srila Prabhupada. Now few minutes about Madhavacharya's pastime. So Madhavacharya appeared in South Karnataka in the holy place of Udupi. So few miles from Udupi is a place called Pajaka Kshetra. And he appeared over there in somewhere around 1238 AD. That is when Madhavacharya appeared. Now during that time there was a Brahmin who used to live in Pajaka Kshetra whose name was Narayan Bhatta, who was from the Madhyageha family of Brahmins. So sometimes he was also referred to as Madhyageha Bhatta. And his wife's name was Vedavati. Now they had two sons, but both the sons died prematurely at childbirth. And after that they were childless for many years. And they had a strong desire to have a son, an illustrious son. So they did so many tapasya, so many austerities they did. And it is said that for 12 years they did this austerity. And they used to walk from Pajaksha Kshetra Udupi by walking, it's quite a big distance. But every day they would walk there and there is a temple of Ananteshwara. So they would go and worship Lord Ananteshwara in that particular temple. And always Madhyageha Bhatt's prayer would be, please grant me a son who will do wonderful work for the benefit of mankind. That was his prayer always, he was praying like that. So for 12 years they did it. It's like they just subsisted on milk when they were doing these austerities, both Madhyageha Bhatta and Vedavati. So one day the pujari came out from the altar of Ananteshwara and he told Madhyageha Bhatta that the Lord has indicated to me that very soon an illustrious son will be born to you. So this obviously enlivened Madhyageha Bhatta and his wife Vedavati. And in due course of time, his wife became pregnant. And then on this most auspicious occasion of Vijayadashmi or Dashera, a very glorious son was born to both of them, whom they named as Vasudev. So Madhavacharya in his childhood was known as Vasudev. Now there are beautiful childhood pastimes of Madhavacharya. So when he was young, when he was 5 years old, his father had given him the Brahmin thread. So he was already, you know, initiated in the Brahmin thread and extremely intelligent, very, very well versed in the scriptures. So once his father was also owning a piece of land. That is how his father would survive. So once his father had actually taken a bullock from one of the money lenders to help, you know, sow grains and all that. But that year he didn't have any crop. So he didn't have anything to give back to this money lender. And the money lender kept coming and telling, you have purchased this bullock from me, you give me the money, give me the money, give me the money. And he said, I don't have anything. So one day this money lender decided, he said, I am going to wait here outside your house and I will fast till you don't give me my money. Now Madhyageha Bhatta was an elevated Brahmin. So he knew the honor of receiving a guest and you know the etiquette that till the guest doesn't eat, we can't eat. So because the guest was not eating, guest means that that money lender was not eating, he could also not eat. And a few days passed like that. And then little Vasudevan came and asked his father, he would tell his son to eat. And he would say, what about you, father? And he said, no, I can't eat because this guest is there outside our house and he's refusing to eat. So then Vasudev understood that, okay, he's, you know, my father owes some money to this particular money lender. So he said, okay, I will solve this problem. So he actually takes, goes and talks to the money lender and he says, come with me. And behind their house was a tamarind tree. So there were a few tamarind seeds which were fallen on the ground. So he takes those tamarind seeds and he gives them in the hand of the money lender. And because little Vasudev was so charming, just 5-year-old boy, he was so charming and sweet in talking, the money lender also took the tamarind seeds. He didn't get angry, what you are giving, your father owes me money and you are giving me these tamarind seeds. So he also took the tamarind seeds from the innocent hands of Vasudev. But then when he opened, he saw they were gold coins. The tamarind seeds had converted into gold coins and they were exactly the same amount of gold coins which his father owed him. So Vasudev asked him, he said, is this enough? Do you think this money is enough? And he said, yes, this is exactly the amount which your father owed me. And then he went to his father and he just said, thank you so much for giving me my money back and you can now eat, I'm going home. So this is a miracle which Vasudev showed in his childhood. He also was extremely playful because he is an incarnation of Bhima and Vayu and Hanuman, very strong physique Madhavacharya had and very involved, very playful, always, you know, doing mischief here and there and very good in sports and athletics. So all the time he would keep, you know, playing outside his school, not attend many classes and his teachers would become very upset with him sometimes. And the teacher would chastise him, Vasudev, you are spending all your time in playing, how will you learn all the scriptures? And Vasudev said, I already know all the scriptures, you ask me what you want. And the teacher would question him on the syllabus of the school and Vasudev would be able to very easily recite everything. And not only what the teachers had taught, he would recite even things which the teachers had not taught to him. He was such a learned scholar. In fact, when the children used to, you know, play, like we see in Lord Nityananda's pastimes, the children would enact lots of dramas based on Puranic stories. Vasudev would be able to, with great accuracy and detail, he would be able to go to the depth of every story and give the children recounts of those stories. And sometimes when elders would listen, they would ask, how do you know all this in so much detail? And he said, oh, I know them from my previous births. So, you know, extremely intelligent, very learned scholar. Sometimes his father used to preach as well because his father was a Brahmin. So when his father would sit and talk and say some shlokas, once his father said a shloka which was not having the correct pronunciation. And little Vasudev sitting in the audience actually told his father what is the correct pronunciation of that shloka. So like that he was very intelligent but very playful. And during his playing, when he was playing outside his school, there was actually a demon called Maniman. Now this demon was also there in the previous Yuga. So he came in the form of a serpent he was living in that particular area of Pajakshetra where Vasudev was living. And he actually came and attacked Vasudev. And Vasudev is Vayuputra, he is Hanuman, he is Bhima. Obviously with so much strength he had. So just with one toe of his foot, he pulverized the head of the serpent. And the serpent died instantly. He lost all his air and he died instantly. And it is said that even today, if we go to Pajakakshetra, to Udupi, we can see the tamarind tree from where he took the seeds and made them into gold coins. And we can also see this rock where there is the imprint of the snake, because the snake melted, it got pulverized. And we see the imprint of Vasudev's toe as well, it is said. And then after killing this demon, he was very late in going home. So his mother was saying, from far away he could hear his mother saying, Vasudev, come home, it's time for you to eat prasad. And it is said that in one, it was, you know, quite some distance away, but in one leap, Vasudev jumped and he reached in front of his mother, because he did not want his mother to worry more. So in this pastime, he displayed both his forms as Hanuman, he leaped and went that distance, and as Bhima, he actually pulverized, with his great strength, he pulverized the serpent. Now when he was around 10 or 12 years old, because obviously he had come to fulfill a certain purpose, so he wanted to take sannyas, and he told his father, and he started looking for a guru as well. So he walked to the Ananteshwar temple near Udupi, and he met a very great elevated devotee called Achyuta Priksha, and he decided that he will accept him as his guru, and he started studying under him. Now Achyuta Priksha was a very elevated devotee, and he started teaching Madhvacharya lots of things, and Madhvacharya slowly expressed the desire that he wants to take sannyas. So his father and mother were not seeing Madhvacharya much at home, and they started getting concerned that he is not coming home. So his father went, and he went, like we see, you know, sometimes when somebody decides to accept Brahmacharya ashram, the parents want them to become grahasthas, have grandchildren and look after them in their old age. So similarly, here we see Madhya Gihabhat also does that. He goes to Udupi and he goes to the ashram of Achyuta Priksha, and he requests Vasudev. He says, please come back home, your mother and I are alone, we are getting very old, who will look after us in our old age? It is the duty of the son to look after us. But Vasudev was completely determined. He said, no, I am going to take sannyas, you please give me your blessings. So then, you know, he tried everything, he tried pleading, Madhya Gihabhat, he tried crying, but nothing was working. He even tried, said, I'll attempt suicide. And Vasudev said, okay, here is the cloth. But he said, I am going to take sannyas. And then he said, Madhya Gihabhat said, but a son has to look after the parents in their old age. Who will look after us? You are our only child. We don't have any other children. So then Vasudev said, okay, if I fulfill this condition of yours, you have to give me approval to take sannyas. So that time, obviously, Madhya Gihabhat did not want to agree. But he just wanted to diffuse the situation. Because he thought, we are anyway getting so old, where my wife is going to have one more child at this age. So he said, yeah, okay. But because of Vasudev's determination, he actually blessed his mother to have one more son. And soon the wife became pregnant in her old age, and she had another son. So then Vasudev again went to his father and said that, you had promised me you will give me blessings to take sannyas. Now you have another son to look after you. You have to give me blessings. Because he was following that culture and etiquette which was there in the olden days, that if you don't take blessings of your parents before taking sannyas, then it is not potent, or you will not get the effect of that, but you will get the reactions of not taking blessings from your parents. So then, you know, the parents said, no, we cannot do. We cannot give you blessings to take sannyas. You please stay here. We cannot bear separation from you. And then Vasudev ultimately said, he told his mother and father that if you give me blessings and I take sannyas, I will come and visit you sometimes. But if you don't give me blessings, I will still take sannyas, but I will never come and see you again. So then the parents had no choice. So with great reluctance, they gave him blessings that at least our son will come and see us sometimes. And then there was a huge function that was held in the Ananteshwara temple, and everybody had come from Pajaka Kshetra and from Udupi to witness that this 12-year, at the age of 12, Vasudev took sannyas. That this 12-year-old boy is actually coming to take sannyas. And Achyuta Priksha, his guru, gave him the sannyas name as Purna Pragna at that time. So that was Vasudev's name when he took sannyas. And then obviously, once he took sannyas, the whole purpose for him to take sannyas was to spread God consciousness and devotion to Lord Krishna throughout the holy land of Bharata. So he started his preaching activities. And there was too much Advaitism and some remnants of Buddhism also there. So much of Mayavad philosophy and so much of propagation of, you know, impersonalism was there in the world at that time. So his whole efforts were on how to destroy this Mayavad philosophy, and that's what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu took as one of the principles, that how to defeat Mayavadis. So that was Madhavacharya's whole purpose, that no, there is an eternal supreme lord who has a form, and we have to serve him. We are separate. Jivas are separate from him, and we have to serve him. We are not one with the Lord. Because Buddhism is talking about nirvishesh, like shunyavadi or voidism, that there is no God, there is nothing after death. And Mayavadis say, yes, there is a God, but we become God, or we merge into him after death. So both these philosophies he was defeating through his vigorous preaching activities. And most people, you know, they got defeated and they surrendered. And there is a beautiful pastime narrated where the two leaders of Buddhism and Mayavad, Advaitism, they came to debate with this little boy. And they both got defeated. Very systematically he defeated both of them. And they had to, you know, accept humble defeat and they went away from there. So like that, so many people were surrendering, because in those days that culture was there. If you get defeated, then you surrender and you become a disciple of that particular person. So many people were surrendering and becoming disciples of Madhvacharya. And Achyuta Preksha saw this potency of Madhvacharya and he actually wanted to appoint him as the leader of the Math at that time. So again, you know, he called Madhvacharya and all his disciples. There was a big celebration and he appointed him the leader of the Math. And that time he gave him the name as Ananda Tirtha. But he was also lovingly always called as Madhava, like that people used to call him because of his devotion to Lord Krishna. And that name, Madhvacharya preferred to be called by that name because it had the name of Lord Krishna in it. And therefore his name is more famous as Madhvacharya. Even though he was given these titles, his birth name was Vasudev, then his sannyas name was Purna Pragna. When he became the leader of the Math, his name was Ananda Tirtha. But then he stuck to that name because he preferred the name Madhvacharya. So he used to take his disciples and tour South India. And during one of these tours, he met the Acharya of the Sringeri Math, which is obviously following the Advaita, Shankara Sampradaya, they were following the Advaita school in South India. And there was a healthy discussion that started between both of them about what Madhvacharya's philosophy is establishing Dvaita. Establishing there is a personal form of the Lord and we are His servants. Jiva souls are separate and Jiva souls are servant of the Lord. And obviously, Acharya of the Sringeri Math was talking about Advaitism. So very systematically, again, Madhvacharya defeated him. But this Acharya told him, because he was presenting his arguments based on the Shariraka Bhashya, which is the commentary of the Bhagavad Gita by Shankaracharya. And he told Madhvacharya that where are you presenting your philosophical arguments from? What are you basing them on? You don't even have a commentary on the Bhagavad Gita. So then, you know, Madhvacharya thought, okay, I'm going to take this as an instruction and I'm going to write a commentary on a Vaishnava commentary on the Bhagavad Gita. So from, you know, that Acharya who was an Advaitist, he took that instruction. But he said, before I write the commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, I have to take blessings from the original author of the Bhagavad Gita, who is none other than Vyasadeva. So he took few of his disciples and he said, okay, we will, because he knew Vyasadeva never leaves this planet. He's always there in Badrikashram, sitting and meditating. So he took few of his disciples and he started that trip towards Badrikashram. And when they reached Badrikashram, he went into the temple of Badrinath. And the disciples were waiting outside and they could actually hear a conversation where Madhvacharya is praying to Lord Badrinath that give me the empowerment and the blessings that I'm able to write a commentary on the Bhagavad Gita. And they could actually see, the disciples could actually hear him, Lord Badrinath talking to Madhvacharya and telling him, yes, you have all my blessings and you have the empowerment to write. Go ahead and write this commentary. And then from there, he decided that he has to go to Adi Badri. So Adi Badri is the highest peak in the Badrinath, where it is said that Vyasadeva lives. So he told his disciples that y'all won't be able to come. Now y'all return. I will go to Adi Badri and I will then come back. I will take blessings from Vyasadeva, my eternal guru, and then I will come back. But he had a disciple called Satya Tirtha, who was always by the side of Madhvacharya, very devoted disciple. And even when Madhvacharya used to, like, you know, speak, preach, he was the scribe. He would write down all these books and whatever Madhvacharya was preaching. So Satya Tirtha went with him and they started walking towards Adi Badri. And for days and days they were walking through thick snow without having eaten anything, even without drinking. And Satya Tirtha was becoming completely exhausted. So Madhvacharya then told Satya Tirtha that you will not be able to proceed further from here. You actually go back now where all the other disciples are there and with them you go back to Udupi. And you know, with one click of the hand, he actually just touched Satya Tirtha and Satya Tirtha reached where all the other disciples were standing at the foot of Badrikashram. So obviously, because he is Vayu, so one click of the hand means by the power of Vayu they have Satya Tirtha. Otherwise, it had taken them days and days to come to this particular spot. But in one moment, Satya Tirtha was there with the other disciples. And then Madhvacharya actually proceeded to Adi Badri. So he continued, and at last he reached Adi Badri. And over there, sitting amongst the snow under a tree, he had the beautiful darshan of his Gurudev Vyasadeva. And he went, and Vyasadeva was surrounded by sages, and they were discussing Srimad Bhagavatam at that time. So Madhvacharya goes and pays obeisances to Vyasadeva. He falls like a stick at the lotus feet of Vyasadeva. Vyasadeva is also so happy to see Madhvacharya, and he actually accepted him as a disciple, and he gave him blessings to write the commentary on the Bhagavad Gita. So he came back and he wrote the commentary, and then now he had a commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, so he started preaching very vigorously. And he was also a great singer. So not only was, you know, great athlete, great physical strength, very vigorous preacher, defeating all the Mayavadis, establishing Dvaitavad, but he was also a very beautiful singer. So it is said he used to compose songs on the glorification of Lord Krishna, and he would keep singing them. So one day he was singing like this, and he was sitting on the beach, which is next to Udupi. And he saw there was a strong wind going, like a storm was happening. And he saw there was one boat which had come from Dwarka. It had got stuck. And just with the wave of his chadar, he actually loosened the boat. Again, Vayudev. So he helped the boat which had got stuck, and he directed the boat safely to the shore. So the captain of the boat was so thankful, very grateful to Madhvacharya. And he said, I'm carrying so many valuables in this boat. I want to give you some precious gift. You please accept it. And Madhvacharya said, I am a simple sannyasi. What will I do with all these gifts? However, sannyasis do apply tilak. And since you are coming from Dwarka, if you have, Dwarka's Gopi Chandan is very famous. If you have some Gopi Chandan, that you give me, because then I can apply tilak. And the captain said, oh, I have blocks and blocks of Gopi Chandan in my boat, because we use it to balance the boat, because that will add weight to the boat. So we have used it to balance the boat. I can give you those. So all, you know, they started carrying those blocks, and one of the blocks actually fell down on the beach and it crashed open, and from there the beautiful deity of Udupi Krishna was manifested. So Udupi Krishna ki
jai.
So that beautiful deity manifested, where Krishna is holding a churning rod, a rope and some butter in his hand. Now there's, you know, very nice pastime of how this Udupi Krishna manifested. In Dwarka, Mother Devaki was requesting Krishna when Krishna's manifest leelas are there. Devaki says that as soon as you were born, you requested us to shift you to Gokul. And we never saw your childhood pastimes. We never saw that form of yours where you would heap butter. You please show me that form where you would hold Mother Yashoda's churning rod. You would stand there and you would heap butter. You show me that form. And your cowherding pastimes, we never saw all that. So Krishna immediately manifested his form as the young Krishna who was in Gokul Vrindavan, who would herd cowherds, you know, cows with a rope, and he would have that churning rod of Mother Yashoda and butter in one hand. So that is what he manifested to show to Mother Devaki. But it's said that Rukmini Devi took darshan of that form when Krishna manifested it for Devaki, and she requested Lord Krishna, because she became so attracted to that form. She said, I want to worship you in this particular form, my Lord, because it is so attractive, your childhood form. And then, you know, Krishna got a beautiful deity cow for Mother Rukmini. And Rukmini had personally worshipped this deity, which we see was, you know, gifted to Madhvacharya, and we see which is there even today in Udupi temple. So that is the history of this deity. Mother Devaki personally had darshan, and then Rukmini personally worshipped this particular deity of Krishna. So he established a beautiful temple in Udupi for the worship of Krishna, and therefore he came to be known as Udupi Krishna. And he had 8 principal disciples whom he called as Mathadipatis. And they would rotate every 2 years. They would take charge of the mutt and they would run the mutt. And then he established 8 mutts. So then they would go back to their own mutt. So after many years of preaching like this, he again had a desire to go and meet his Guru. So he again took that trip to Adi Badri. And that time when he met his Guru, Vyasadeva was very pleased. Again he embraced him. And that time Vyasadeva gave him the instruction that you write the commentary on Mahabharata now. And sitting over there in Adi Badri only, Madhvacharya wrote the whole commentary on the Mahabharata. So, and that is the commentary on which most of the, you know, now the current commentaries of Mahabharata based on that original commentary, because it is a Vaishnava commentary on the Mahabharata. And also Vyasadeva, just out of love for his disciple, he gifted him 8 Shaligram Shilas. And these Shaligram Shilas are actually being worshipped even now in the Udupi Krishna temple. So when every, those 8 Mathadipatis are there, when all of those Mathadipatis take charge, they actually worship these Shaligram Shilas along with the Udupi Krishna deity very lovingly. And Madhavacharya has established very high standard of worship in Udupi Krishna. So, you know, there was a lecture which was in last year, there was a parikrama that had happened, virtual parikrama, online parikrama. Yeah, Tirth Yatra. And that time they described how the whole, you know, worship happens from morning to evening of Udupi Krishna. Such a nice way they worship that deity. So that is the second principle Chaitanya Mahaprabhu took from Madhavacharya, or from this particular sampradaya, is how the Archa Vigraha is an eternal representation of Lord Krishna. And, you know, deity worship is accepted as an eternal worship of Lord Krishna. And, you know, in 2 minutes we'll discuss even the disappearance. It's very unique the way in which Madhavacharya disappeared. So he was, I think, 79 or 80 years old, and he had already started indicating to his disciples that I'm going to leave this world soon, I'm going to leave this world soon. And one day, you know, outside the Udupi temple there is a big slab of stone. So normally he would sit there and he would preach. Whenever he was giving lectures and all, he would sit there and he would preach. Even writing books, everything, he used to sit on that slab of stone. So one day he was sitting and talking. Obviously he was preaching, there was a huge group of devotees that had gathered over there to hear from him. And while preaching like that, he suddenly disappeared from this world. And he was telling everybody that I'm going to go and join my guru and serve him eternally. So it is said that his cloth and the garland that he was wearing, they just suddenly fell and his body disappeared from there. And at that moment, it is said flowers actually fell from the sky. The demigods were showering flowers over there just to celebrate the auspicious disappearance of this great Acharya. So he went and joined his guru Vyasadeva in Adi Bradripadri to serve him eternally over there. So these are some of the glories of Madhavacharya, because we are the Brahma Madhava Gaudiya Sampradaya. Especially this Acharya has a lot of prominence and significance in our own Sampradaya, because Chaitanya Mahaprabhu accepted his disciples as his guru. So, you know, on the appearance day of these Acharyas, they are very merciful. So we pray that we get some blessings from these Acharyas. We also become a bit serious in our Krishna consciousness and devote ourselves to Srila Prabhupada mission and spreading the mission like Madhavacharya was spreading Krishna consciousness all over the world at that time. So we'll stop here. Any questions or comments or corrections? In the class here, Granthraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Jai Nitai Gaur Premanande.